My question tonight is, how big is God? How big is God? About 500 years ago, on the 31st of October, 1517, Martin Luther famously nailed his 95 theses, that just means 95 sentences, to the door of the church in his village. And it's this event that we celebrate this year. It's 500 years since Luther began the Protestant Reformation. And what he was doing when he nailed those 95 sentences to the door of the castle church was to shake the cage and ask the church of his day, what is grace? Where can we find grace? Where can I find a gracious God? He particularly was talking about penance and whether the only way you can find grace is if you confess your sins to a priest. Luther was challenging the church of his day with some important questions, and we need to find important answers. But at the same time, not very far away in Switzerland, there was another reformer named Zwingli. And he wanted to rattle the cage, but he didn't do it so much through presenting new ideas. First of all, he wanted to abolish the mercenary trade, where young boys were being sold into other armies. Swiss youth were being compromised, were being brutalized by being sold to make war. And he wanted to stop the pilgrimages where people would walk for hundreds of miles, sometimes on their knees, thinking that that way they might earn merit before God. And he was quite successful. At least his small town called Zurich became a Protestant city. Not very far away from him, a few years later, John Calvin, a Frenchman, arrived at the invitation of the Genevan City Council. And he did something radical in his city. Traditionally, people had thought of ministers in a hierarchy, bishops, priests, and deacons. And Calvin says, no, ministry shouldn't be understood as a hierarchy. He flipped it and said, ministry is clergy and lay people working together where no one is superior to anyone else. And, he said, we need to have a teaching ministry whereby the Bible is taught morning and night, especially on Sundays, so that people can learn what a true church is about. And with quite a degree of success, Calvin changed Geneva. But Luther in his small territory in Germany, or Zwingli in his small city called Zurich, or Calvin in his small city called Geneva, had an impact, but that would be nothing like what Queen Elizabeth I of England tried to do. She tried to change a whole country. Can God change a whole nation? Is God big enough not just to transform a small town in Germany or a small city in Switzerland? Can God change a nation? And who would be up to the task? Well, in the last few weeks, Peter's introduced you to some characters in the English Reformation, and by all reports today, people have enjoyed the series. Henry VIII had kind of swung a bit between being Catholic and Protestant. He never really worked out his mind. His son, Edward, came to the throne, and England veered distinctly towards the Protestant cause. But Edward died young, and his sister Mary took the throne, and she pushed England back towards the Catholic, Roman Catholic cause. England had swung dangerously in the course of just a few years. Who could settle England? Could England ever be a Protestant nation? Who would be big enough under God to lead that kind of change? Well, you might have seen some movies about Queen Elizabeth. Cate Blanchett, I think, is in the most famous of the recent ones. Elizabeth had a hard life because her mother was beheaded when she was a very young girl. And she was traumatized by the event and in some ways abused. Her mother conceived her, that is Anne Boleyn, conceived her to Henry VIII out of wedlock. So in many minds, she was a bastard child. She grew up and her half-sister Mary took the throne, and Mary treated her abominably and cruelly. She was jailed and under house arrest because Mary wanted her kingdom to be Catholic and Elizabeth was more likely to be Protestant. She was a woman growing up in a man's world, and besides all of that, England was at war with France and Spain. And on the European continent, there was great religious turmoil. England was in the midst of an extraordinary moment. Could she become a Protestant land? Yes. Yes and yes. Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth I, settled England. She had a genuine Protestant faith. And she ruled not heavy-handedly, but with popular consent. And she turned whatever events happened in the life of the nation towards Protestant goals. She pursued wise diplomacy with other nations. England's great blessing was to receive a queen like Elizabeth. God was so big that he could change a whole land. After all, we should have known that from Proverbs chapter 21, verse 1, which says, "The king's heart," or perhaps we might think the queen's heart, "is a stream of water in the hands of the Lord, and he turns it wherever he will." God can even use a king or queen to help the gospel advance in the nation. Well, Elizabeth came to the throne in the year 1558, and she very quickly got to work to set up a Protestant rule. First of all, through her parliament, she saw an act passed called the Act of Supremacy, which said that there was to be no pope with authority in England, and that she would be the governor of her church. She didn't use the word head. It was dangerous for a woman in those days to describe herself as head of the church. No, she described herself as the governor of the church. And still to this day, Queen Elizabeth II in England has the title Supreme Governor of the Church. But Elizabeth did more than just say, this country's not going to have a pope. Elizabeth also passed through her parliament some legislation called the Act of Uniformity. That meant that every church service in England had to be exactly the same. There was to be no difference, no variety. Every word was prescripted. And she gave to England a prayer book, the Book of Common Prayer, which was to guide their worship. But notice that word, the Book of Common Prayer. Do you know what that means? It means that there was only to be one book that the people and the priest used together. Previously, the priest had his own book and the people had their book, and they were shown, therefore, that they were inferior to the priest because the priest had his own special book, right? No, Elizabeth says, everyone prays from the same book. This is a book of common prayer. We're all equal before the Lord. There's no spiritual hierarchy before the Lord. This is a book of common prayer. And she wanted to prove it, making sure that when you came to church, it wasn't just that the priest received bread and wine, all the laity would receive bread and wine as well. Because before the Reformation, the priest would take bread and wine in communion, but everyone else just took bread to remind you that you weren't as superior as the priest was. You weren't really the church, actually. You were just observing the church. The real church was the clergy. No, Elizabeth insists that people, everyone, should take bread and wine. And that when the priest was at the Lord's table, this was not the priest offering a sacrifice to God, as had been the traditional pattern. No, this was God giving a gift of assurance to the people. You weren't offering a sacrifice. God was giving you a gift. And when you took the bread and the wine, you were being reassured of your faith, and you were being nurtured in your faith, and you were being encouraged in your faith, and you were being presented with the gospel to eat and to drink. Elizabeth believed that if you wanted to change the nation, you had to change the way church services were organized. You would pray the nation to become Protestant. Now, there's some things that Elizabeth did that not everyone liked. So catch this, right? She said that the clergy must wear robes. Scandalous, right? She believed that the clergy should still show that they are under authority, under hers, by wearing certain religious robes. She also said that it's okay if you want to take the bread and the wine to kneel around the communion table. And for some people, that was really weird because they thought that meant that you're worshipping the bread and the wine. She said, no, it's okay. If you want to kneel before you take it, that's fine. We won't understand that to mean that you're worshipping the bread and the wine. We'll just take that to mean that you're coming to the Lord humbly. And she made sure there were two prayers you could pray when you took the bread and the wine. One that felt a little bit more Catholic, and one that felt a little bit more Protestant. But not everyone was happy with those kinds of decisions. But it must be said that Elizabeth was a Protestant leader, and she created a Protestant church. There was no Pope in England. Christ ruled through his word. The church was not graded into the spiritually superior and the spiritually inferior. There was just one church. We're all equal together before the Lord, right? And that the communion service wasn't a sacrifice, as the priests under the traditional way of doing things had argued, but the communion is a gift to you and me to encourage us in our walk. Well might she have quoted Proverbs 16:15. In the light of a king's face there is life, and his favour is like the clouds that bring the spring rain. Queen Elizabeth brought spring rains to freshen the church in England. Well, so far, I've told you something of Elizabeth's story and explained a little bit Elizabeth's settlement, how she arranged the church in her country. But I need to explain just for a few minutes as well what made Elizabeth tick. What was her spirituality? How did she think about her own walk with the Lord? And how did she think about how we should all walk with the Lord? These are the kinds of things that guided her reform of the nation. She said, first of all, that she didn't want to look into human souls to see what they really believed. She was prepared to treat you as a Christian if you called yourself a Christian. The technical word is she believed in the judgment of charity. She wanted to think the best of you. And if you called yourself a Christian, she was wanting you to not only behave as a Christian, but be treated as a Christian in church. Effectively, she was saying it's better to leave some unbelievers in church. That's a better thing to do than to continually look into people's hearts and make sure those kinds of believers didn't belong to church, because the danger with that is that you might chuck out a baby believer. It's better to err on the side of including people in than be too strong in pushing people out. Just like Jesus says in the parable that was read for us from Matthew 13. An enemy has come in and sowed weeds amongst the wheat. And what does Jesus say? The servants say, do you want us to go and gather the weeds? And Jesus says, no, lest in gathering the weeds you root up the wheat along with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And at harvest time, I'll tell the reapers, gather the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, and gather the wheat into my barn. There's a case to be made for not pursuing people's hearts too closely. It's better to include people in rather than chucking out people who might actually just be baby believers. Or as Proverbs 17:3 says, the crucible is for silver and the furnace for gold, but it's the Lord who tests the heart. So what did Elizabeth want to do? She wanted us to think the best of each other. She wanted us to be humble and think the best of the person who's sitting next to you in church tonight. She wants her church to know humility. Second, she wanted her church to prioritise love over liberty. See, she actually didn't like the church that she was overseeing. She would much prefer to have had celibate clergy, clergy who weren't married. She would prefer to have only organ music. She would prefer to have candles on the communion table and lots of religious symbols around the walls. But she didn't insist on that for others. She said, my preference is to be a bit more religious, a bit more churchy, but I'm not going to insist on it for you. Isn't that wonderful, where people think, I would prefer one thing, but for the sake of you, my neighbour, I'm going to deny myself something so that you might better worship or that you might better be encouraged. Or as Proverbs 10:12 says, hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all offences. She wanted her church to be characterised by humility and love. And thirdly, she was of the mind that slow and steady wins the race. She didn't want necessarily people to be spiritually intense so that the only way you could do church is everyone's totally fired up. No, she kept saying, major on the majors. She said to her clergy, keep preaching Christ. Keep preaching Christ. Keep pointing people to Christ, and their experience, their love for the Lord will grow. Our job isn't to make you spiritual. Our job is to preach Christ so that you can grow in your love for him. Keep preaching the message of Christ. She didn't want to legislate what it was like to be a Christian. Or from Proverbs 14:16, one who is wise is cautious and turns away from evil, but a fool is reckless and careless. She wanted her church to grow slowly. She thought it was better to grow slowly for the ministers to teach patiently than to push people too far too fast. That a test of you being a true Christian is not that you're fired up, it's that in your own way you love the Lord. She wanted her church to experience humility and love and patient teaching on Christ. Now, if I'd been the King of England in her day, I might have done things slightly differently. I might have wanted to add a few things to these, her spiritual principles. But these are the foundations that she laid, and we can be very thankful that the church, the Anglican Church in Australia, for example, sees humility and love and patience as virtues that we want to protect and promote. Elizabeth, Queen of England, was a wise woman and a wise leader in difficult, in tumultuous times. And the way she created the church in England as a Protestant church still impacts us today in Australia. For we are a national church. There's not one square inch of Australia that some minister somewhere is not responsible for presenting the gospel to. That's kind of one of the advantages of being Anglican. You can say, in the best of all worlds, every square inch of Australia is being evangelized. She decided to do it through bishops. That's part of our national structure. But behind that is the vision for a national church, that the gospel should be preached to everyone, not just to niche demographics. And one of the great things we can thank God for in providing for us Queen Elizabeth is that she made the leadership of the church pastorally sensitive. She didn't want the minister just to preach doctrine. She wanted the ministers to preach doctrine so that you and I could flourish, so that you and I could grow, so that you and I could love the Lord, that we could be cared for by those set over us in the church. Doctrine's important because doctrine actually helps us to live healthy Christian lives. And we can be thankful to God for Elizabeth, in as far as she wanted people to see that in every day, in every way, you can meet the Lord. That there's no holy place or holy time or holy clergy, but that everyday life, your life, exciting or not exciting, flashy or not flashy, is a place where you can learn the Lord's love for you. The spirituality that she encouraged was a spirituality of everyday patient obedience, even if we're not feeling terribly spiritual. Friends, we can be so thankful for the leadership that Elizabeth gave. Her story was extraordinary. Her legal settlement was profound, and her spirituality has shaped the structure and the expectations of the Anglican Church even to this day. And though we live in vastly different time, we can nonetheless be thankful for these foundations that here at St. Alf's we can build on. So as I conclude, let me pray a prayer that Elizabeth herself wrote and prayed for her nation and for her church. Stretch forth, O Lord most mighty, thy right hand over me, and defend me from my enemies, that they may never prevail against me. Give me, O Lord, the assistance of thy Spirit, and the comfort of thy grace, truly to know thee, entirely to love thee, and assuredly to trust in thee. And that as I do acknowledge to have received the government of this church and the kingdom from thy hand, and to hold the same of thee, so grant me grace, O Lord, that in the end I may render up and present the same again to thee, a peaceable, quiet, and well-ordered state and kingdom, as also a perfect, reformed church, to the furtherance of thy glory. And to my subjects, O Lord, grant, I beseech thee, faithful and obedient hearts, willingly to submit themselves to the obedience of thy word and your commandments, that we all together, being thankful unto thee for benefits received, may praise and magnify thy holy name, world without end. Grant this, merciful Father, for Jesus Christ's sake, our only mediator and advocate. Amen.